This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, a vocabulary lesson from the Federal Reserve. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 20th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The macroeconomic word of the day this Wednesday is patient. Patient. It's an adjective, able to accept or tolerate delays, problems, or suffering without becoming annoyed or anxious. Patient. What's that? You want it in a sentence? Sure.
Given the overall favorable conditions in our economy, my colleagues and I will be patient in assessing what, if any, changes in the stance of policy may be needed.
Patient. Fed Chair Jay Powell there giving the central bank's economic outlook and vocabulary lesson all in one, explaining, by way of wrapping up a two-day Fed meeting, why they are not planning any more interest rate increases this year. Why? No more rate hikes? Here's another sentence.
FOMC participants continue to see growth this year of around 2%, just a bit below what we saw back at the end of last year.
Things are good, Powell said, but not great. What gives? Well, here is, I guess you'd call it a sentence fragment, right?
And now we see a situation where the European economy has slowed substantially, and where so has the Chinese economy, although the European economy more. And just as strong global growth was a tailwind, weaker global growth can be a headwind to our economy.
Chair Powell also did a bit of thinking out loud, I guess you'd say, as he processed the questions he was getting this afternoon.
You ask about tariffs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes, we did. The answer came in two parts.
In terms of our own economy, the level of tariffs is relatively small in the size of our economy.
However, comma.
We have since the beginning of the year and before, really, been hearing from our extensive network of business contacts a lot of concerns about tariffs, concerns about material costs on imported products and the loss of markets and things like that, depending on which industry. So there's a fair amount of uncertainty. It's hard to say how much of an effect that's having on our economy.
Along those lines, by the way, President Trump said this afternoon when he was asked about the tariffs he's got on China, he was asked whether and when they are going to be lifted. Here is the quote. "We are not talking about removing them," the president said of his tariffs. "We are talking about leaving them for a substantial period of time," end of quote. So there's that. Last thing, and then we'll move on. If this is Wednesday, there must be Brexit news. And oh, look, there is. Here's Prime Minister Theresa May in Parliament today.
I have therefore this morning written to President Tusk, the President of the European Council, informing him that the UK seeks an extension to the Article 50 period until the 30th of June.
Can't see me right now, but I'm doing one of those both hands up, shoulder height, shrugging things. May goes to Brussels tomorrow for, yes, another crucial Brexit meeting with the EU. Deadline is supposed to be March the 29th, a week from Friday. Wall Street on this relatively heavy macroeconomic news day. Traders took a while to figure out how they felt about things. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It is, a glance at the calendar confirms, mid-March in the year 2019. But politically speaking, things feel more like March 2020. More than a dozen Democrats are in the presidential race. Feels like there are more getting in every day, followed, depending on who it is who's getting in, by a stream of money. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from Washington, on a particular political money turn of phrase you have probably been hearing a lot lately.
I am no longer accepting corporate PAC checks.
I will not take corporate PAC money.
Boy, I wouldn't be doing my job well if I didn't mention that since we're not taking corporate PAC money.
Those were Democratic presidential candidates Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, and Pete Buttigieg, swearing off donations from corporate political action committees, PACs. It makes for a powerful pledge, but what does rejecting that money mean for a campaign's bottom line?
Well, for presidential candidates, it doesn't really mean too much.
Brendan Glavin is a senior data analyst at the Campaign Finance Institute. He points out that corporate PACs can donate only $5,000 per candidate. That money means a lot in, say, a congressional race, but
historically, presidential campaigns are about individual contributions.
For instance, corporate PAC money made up just 0.01% of the money Donald Trump raised in the 2016 election. For Hillary Clinton, it was
less than 0.5% of the money she raised.
So why so much of this?
That's why I have said I will not take corporate contributions.
Branding, says David Rare, director of the Center for Civic Engagement at George Mason University. Rare was a lobbyist for years. He's also run a couple of PACs. He says candidates may well be opposed to corporate money in politics. Then there's enlightened self-interest.
Is the value of the corporate money I'm going to receive greater than the value of the votes and support I receive from people who are distasteful of corporate PACs?
And why corporate PACs in particular? Industry groups, associations, and nonprofits have PACs too. Rare finds the backlash kind of ironic.
Many voters don't like corporations and therefore are suspicious of corporate PACs, when it is probably the cleanest money in politics today, the way it is regulated and the limits that are put on it.
Clean is a pretty relative term when it comes to money in politics. But corporate PACs do have restrictions on who can contribute, how much, and the PAC has to disclose its spending and its donors.
And they're pretty clear about why they're giving to candidates. They give to candidates or members of Congress that they believe help their bottom lines.
Tiffany Muller is president of End Citizens United. She's happy so many candidates are rejecting corporate PACs, or even all PAC money, but it's the big money she's worried about, especially from super PACs, which can't donate directly to candidates, but can raise and spend unlimited money to support or oppose one.
What we're hoping is that we actually could get all candidates to disavow single-candidate super PAC help.
But even with all the disavowing, rejecting, and refusing, companies will still have plenty of ways to influence the 2020 campaign. They often sponsor the party conventions, executives and staff can donate on an individual basis, and that's the money we can see. So-called dark money is sure to play a big role in 2020 as well, and we'll get little or no information about where it's coming from. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We were talking for a bit yesterday about Instagram and how it can pretty narrowly target ads to its users. Today, parent company Facebook, which has settled charges of discriminatory advertising. It's also announced new steps it is taking to change the ad technology it uses to make it harder for advertisers to target or to exclude, if you want to put it another way, people based on characteristics like gender and race. Marketplace's Jack Stewart looked into when micro-targeting like that crosses the line into discrimination.
Advertisers always want to speak to a specific audience. In the past, that meant airing commercials during certain TV shows or buying space in local newspapers. But on Facebook, they can use thousands of data points to aim their ads at defined groups of people.
It is the most powerful targeting platform on the planet.
Dennis Yu's firm, Blitz Metrics, has relied on that targeting to place about $1 billion in ads on Facebook over 12 years on behalf of its clients.
It's showing people what they want based on who they are. That's the core of good advertising.
The ACLU and other civil rights groups sued, saying Facebook's platform also allowed advertisers to hide ads from racial minorities, women, and the elderly. Lisa Rice is president at the National Fair Housing Association, behind one of the lawsuits that Facebook settled.
Algorithmic-based systems and different forms of technology actually enable, they help you scale up the discriminatory outcomes.
As part of the settlement, Facebook's introducing a new process for placing ads related to housing, employment, and credit, areas covered by equal opportunity laws. Facebook's ad revenue was nearly $40 billion in 2017, all powered by the massive amounts of data it has on users. Alice Fournier at Kantar says social media companies have had an easy ride.
They built businesses in a very, very uncharted, unregulated territory, in something that, you know, was brand new to all of us.
But now Facebook's facing pressure from US and European regulators over its data collection. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Podcasts, as those inclined to audio news and storytelling know, are hot right now. Everybody who's anybody has one. But not all podcasts are created equal, as everybody knows. Consider for just a moment the company insider genre.
I would like every employee to be what I call brand obsessed.
I love my job. I have a pinch me moment every single day that I get to do this job.
We can see their problems. We can solve their problems. They can call us for advice and they can call us for help.
Netflix has a podcast, Trader Joe's, Home Depot. There are in all 30 different companies in the S&P 500 making their own podcasts. Austin Hufford wrote about them for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk content here for a minute. What do these podcasts offer in subject matter?
Well, you know, it's not too different than, like, I guess, a radio show or a small podcast.
Hey, now. I'm sitting right here, man.
They interview an executive, you know, and they basically talk about what the executive does, you know, maybe their history, maybe their past. And sometimes they try to get a little bit human and talk about some of their stuff outside of work, too. Right. That's when I think some of them end up having some appeal.
Right. You listened to a bunch, I'm sure, for this story. What grabbed you? What stuck out?
You know, I cover businesses for a living, and so many times they're so buttoned up and, for lack of a better word, boring. You know, if you go to these investment conferences, there's never even hardly a laugh in the room. And I think sometimes it was kind of fun to kind of hear some of these executives sort of speak kind of bluntly at times. Mm-hmm. You maybe even joke around, you know. And, you know, I'm not going to say all of them were always the most interesting, right? I mean, many of them were boring. But occasionally, some of the podcasts had, you know, interesting moments or times when you're like, wow, I could actually understand what this company cares about a little bit better.
It's also kind of an internal communications device, right? It's a little bit of an all-staff company memorandum.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, I think it's easy to kind of make fun of the podcast, and that we do a little bit in the story, but you're not comparing it to the highly produced podcast. You're really comparing it to the internal company memo. And on that metric, I mean, maybe it's probably more fun to listen to an executive talk for 10 minutes than to read some long, boring thing in your email at 6 in the morning.
Yeah, so that's the internals. But also there is a recruiting dimension to this too, right?
Yeah, I mean, people say that when you're deciding to work at a place, you're doing research online, you're Googling things, going on Wikipedia, and also maybe downloading the podcast. And so the idea is like you're trying to create as much content out there that kind of lets an employee know what it's like to work at that company. And they obviously want to put their best face forward.
Should I want to listen to other companies' podcasts? I can just go on Apple Podcasts or whatever my podcast app of choice is, right? They are publicly available, most of them.
Yeah, I mean, some companies like have built their own apps or have worked with other companies to build apps. You know, I don't think you necessarily need to. I think if you're maybe you could listen to ones in your own industry, it wouldn't be crazy to kind of see what some of the competitors are doing. You know, the CEOs are always in the media. They talk a lot. But for some of the mid-level execs, you kind of never get to hear from them directly. Right. And so in that sense, they are helpful in terms of an intelligence tool.
Yeah. For lack of a better word, who is the talent on these podcasts, right? I mean, you've got the corporate executive or you've got whatever the story is. Who's doing the hosting thing?
Usually it's someone from the internal communications team.
Yeah.
You know, for some of these companies, they're actually like radio people. And so, you know, they have the great voice. And we got a couple stories where these people are sort of becoming pseudo internal celebrities. They're being called the Ryan Seacrest of Caterpillar, or they're being recognized in the hallways or the bathrooms or the meetings. And so that's kind of a funny aspect of this all.
Austin Hufford, he covers corporate America for The Wall Street Journal. Austin, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I don't want to be undocumented anymore, anywhere.
Going home to get ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 141 points today, about a half percent, 25,745. NASDAQ was up 5 points, less than a tenth percent, 77.28. S&P 500 down 8 points, about a quarter percent or so, 28.24. The German chemical and pharmaceutical giant Bayer dropped 9.6% today after a jury found that the ubiquitous weed killer Roundup helped trigger a California man's cancer. Bayer acquired Roundup's manufacturer Monsanto. You might remember the company still faces more than 11,000 U.S. lawsuits over the weed killer. With the spring equinox today, we'll dig into the gardening and landscape sector a bit. Scotts Miracle-Gro announced it's going to sell its stake in lawn services company True Green. Miracle-Gro mowed down, love that, mowed down 5.8% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year treasury note, listen to this, and then offer your thanks to Jay Powell, down to 2.52%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The reality of this economy right now is that the devices we use are constantly asking us to share or sometimes just taking our data. And when it comes to that data, not much of it is more personal and private than our health. And yet, personal health devices and apps are a growing industry, a subset of which is targeted specifically at women. Femtech, it's called. Molly McHugh wrote about it for The Ringer. Molly, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Let's do a little definition of terms here first for me, would you? Femtech, what does that encompass?
Sure. So Femtech is shorthand for female technology. It's a huge market and includes everything from period tracking apps to bracelets you wear on your wrist that are sort of tracking things like your heartbeat and how well you're sleeping to determine your fertility cycles. There's lots of other stuff involved in it, but those are some of the main figures in this market.
Extremely handy information to have for users who want to have that kind of information, whether you're trying to figure out pregnancy or what have you. The really sinister question, of course, though, is that data ain't free, right?
Right. Never is. That is the trade-off every time you use any sort of personal tracking device.
Yeah. But this is especially personal. I mean, you know?
Totally. I think the reason I actually got interested in writing the story is that shortly after I got married this past summer, I immediately started getting Instagram ads for things like I should go freeze my eggs or don't I need to start tracking my cycles, which I do not. I'm not trying to get pregnant. I'm not even using any of these apps, and Facebook and Instagram have enough information about that fact that I was getting married, most likely, to start offering me these sorts of things. So it just got me wondering, if you are offering up this information, what else can they figure out about you?
They can figure out lots of stuff. There, I mean, you relayed an article by a woman who worked for the Washington Post about being targeted for ads after her child was stillborn. I mean, it was terrible.
Right. No, it's awful. And she asked a really good question, is that if they know enough to know that she should have been coming home with a child that week, they knew enough to keep offering her ads, but could they not figure out that her child had not lived? Yeah. Which is a great question, you know, like, if you can't sell to me, am I worth anything? The other part of it is that, is it suggesting to people what you should be doing with your life? If I'm in my 20s and I start seeing these ads because I use a period tracking app, does it tell me like, oh, maybe I should get pregnant when maybe I don't want to, or there are other options in my life? So there's a lot of questions that this brings up.
Right. It's the subliminal messaging. Here's the deal, though. It's not like these devices and this data are going to go away.
No, they're not. That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, there are better health outcomes that can happen from using these things. I talked to some people who pointed out that women are not diagnosed with heart disease as often as they should be. And if we can use things like Apple's new watch with its EKG features to find that out, then that's absolutely promising. But that then just leads you to start understanding how important federal regulations are to these devices.
So ordinarily, I wouldn't ask this personal a question, but since you related your own story, let me ask you this. If you decide you're ready to start a family, would you use one of these apps and then pay the price, using you as a proxy for, you know, women writ large?
Oh, that's such a hard and great question. I am very interested in tracking my health and you know, having the best health outcomes. So unfortunately, I think my answer is I would probably use them and then feel a little bit bad about it. I think the best case scenario is that federal regulations do come through for a lot of these things, which would then require them to have much stricter privacy policies. Mm. And I would feel a lot better about using them.
Molly McHugh writes for The Ringer most recently about femtech. Molly, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Almost 10 years ago, Arizona passed a law that let local law enforcement detain anybody they suspected of being in the country illegally. The Supreme Court did eventually strike down most of that law's provisions, Senate Bill 1070 it was called, but the court did let one part of it stand, the part that requires police officers check the immigration status of anybody detained or arrested. The net effect was that some undocumented immigrants went further underground, others just left. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia has the story of one who did leave.
Here on this office building rooftop near downtown Mexico City, there are two guys playing ping pong. It's sunny and hot.
Is it as hot as it would get in Phoenix?
No, not at all. Not at all.
This is Jessica Gonzalez, who's up here taking her lunch break. Her voice is a little raspy today.
I spent the weekend a little bit sick.
Gonzalez immigrated to the U.S. and spent most of her teenage years with family in Phoenix. When she first got to high school there, she didn't speak English.
What I used to do, I used to look at everybody else. Like the teacher was talking, I used to look at other people to see what they were doing. And I started to do the same thing because I wasn't sure what they were talking about.
Gonzalez says she eventually got good grades and graduated in 2010. She wanted to go to college to study genetics, but she didn't have legal status to study or work in the U.S.
I remember there was like this big movement in Phoenix going on where they wanted to do like some law that I don't remember the name.
She's referring to Arizona Senate Bill 1070. When it became law in 2010, immigrant advocates said it encouraged racial profiling. Around that time, Gonzalez says she was riding a city bus when it passed a group of protesters. She says they started pushing and rocking the bus.
And they were screaming and yelling things at me, you know, like, alien, go back to your country, stop stealing jobs from people, things like that.
Soon after, Gonzalez left her father and brothers and moved back to where she was born, Mexico City. She applied to college here, but realized she couldn't afford to be a student because she had a son and needed to earn money. Instead, she got a job at a call center that contracted with large American corporations. She says the callers were often unhappy the person helping them was in Mexico.
And they're like, sometimes later, they're like, no, stupid Mexican, I don't want to speak to you. I don't want to talk to you. Transfer me to someone in America.
Gonzalez worked at call centers for 7 years. She wanted to go to college the whole time, but she couldn't afford it because she was earning less than $3 an hour. She even lived in a house that she shared with other families. And then last year, she heard about a coding school for migrants that would loan her the tuition and a stipend until she got a job. Bruno Torres is one of the mentors at what is called Hola Code.
We're a 5-month intensive coding boot camp for returnees and deportees from the United States.
Gonzalez, who now has 3 children, says she didn't even own a computer, but she knew this would be a path upward.
I didn't know what software engineer was either. I didn't have any idea that that existed.
Some 50 people have graduated since Hola Code opened over a year ago. About 30 are enrolled right now. By the way, back in Phoenix, where Gonzalez grew up, recruiters in the tech sector are struggling to fill vacancies. One of her teachers there, Jane McNamara, says she wishes Gonzalez could have stayed.
I think that it's to all of our benefit to have young people like Jessica in our community working, raising families, and helping us benefit from what's best about both countries.
So would Gonzalez consider going back to live in the U.S.?
Not anymore. I would like to visit my family for sure. I totally miss them a lot. But I don't want to be undocumented anymore, anywhere.
Gonzalez now works at a Mexican financial services startup, and she finally makes enough money to live with her children in their own apartment. In Mexico City, I'm Jorge Valencia for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a bit lost in the shuffle as things have been getting of late. The European Union hit Google with a $1.7 billion fine today, anti-competitive practices in its ad business, apparently. Two quick follows to that. One, including today, the EU has hit that company with a bit more than $9 billion in penalties. Also, and related, in its most recent quarter, Google's revenue, and again, this is just October through December of last year, total revenue, money brought in, $39 billion American dollars. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 141 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 5, less than a tenth percent. S&P 500 down 8, more than a quarter percent there. Our media production team includes Sarah Begair, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.